KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm very excited to have on Professor Shubha Ghosh of the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Law, author of the just-released book Identity, Invention, and the Culture of Personalized Medicine Patenting out of Cambridge University Press. We've spent a good amount of time over the last several years on Hearsay Culture discussing a variety of topics related to patent law reform. We've had on guests like Mark Lemley and Dan Burke and Mike Moyer and David K. Levine and McKelly Boldrin and others who have taken a variety of positions on how patent law is working and how it isn't. And on occasion, we've also had on scholars that focus on a specific problem or issue in patent law and analyze it from a variety of perspectives to look at either solutions to the problem or rethinking our theory behind it or just rethinking the issue entirely. And in Identity, Invention, and the Culture of Personalized Medicine Patenting, Shubha takes a hard look at one of the biggest problems vexing patent scholars as well as patent practitioners, judges, and so forth. And that is the use of patents and patent law in medical diagnoses, in genes, and literally patenting people's identities. If we think about genetic code and genetic information as, of course, being linked to an individual, and we think about the idea of patents as allowing ownership and propertization of that information, it raises serious concerns of privacy, serious concerns about what kind of choices people make, and literally serious concerns about ownership when patents get involved. And so the concept of personalized medicine ties in with this very heavily because we have advanced our understanding of biology as well as our understanding of genetics to allow for medical treatment and medical diagnoses to be individualized. We are able to gather enough information about an individual to allow a given treatment plan to be set for one individual in a way that might be different for others. And of course, we've been doing that for quite a while. But the use of patents here is a relatively new issue. One of the leading cases in patent law, the case of Chakrabarti that we'll be talking about, that we'll be talking about a bit on the show, allowed for the general concept of patentable subject matter, that is, what is literally patentable, to include, in fact, something that is living so long as it is made by man. In other words, it was not part of a natural process. And what we're dealing with here and what we're going to be discussing today on the show moves beyond that issue to think about the personalized medicine industry and how that industry uses patents and particularly how it might patent in ways that can be problematic at any number of levels. In Shubha's book, he approaches this issue both from a normative and philosophical and theoretical perspective, but also from an empirical and very practical perspective. And so he, in one of his chapters, gathered quite a bit of data on patents that use racial criteria or race-based patenting. And so we're going to be talking a bit about that as well as more broadly how these kinds of patents are used today in the medical industry, which again raises a variety of vexing questions. And Shubha is well positioned as a prolific scholar to answer them in connection with his book. So I'm very excited to have Shubha on today to discuss this really interesting and challenging problem. He is joining us from Madison via Skype. We are recording on October 9th for air on October 10th. And I thank you, Shubha, for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
No, thank you, David. I always love to follow Hearsay Culture and contribute whenever I can, so thank you again.
I appreciate it. Let's start off, Shubha, with a question I ask most of the authors I have on the show. Tell us about the genesis of your interest in this topic and why you wrote the book.
Well, in some ways, this book is ripped from the headlines, as the cliche goes. At least maybe the smaller headlines. In 2005, there were several reports about the Food and Drug Administration approving a drug called Bidel. And the drug was designed by a company called Nitramed to alleviate hypertension of African-American population. So it was a race-specific drug. It was a drug that had been approved for use with the treatment of a particular racial group. And so that was the reason there was so much attention given to that particular drug in 2005. And I write a lot in the area of intellectual property. I've been particularly interested in the pharmaceutical area, the overlap with intellectual property and pharmaceuticals and access to medicines. And I've done work in that area in developing countries. And this struck me as a very interesting question in a developed country. And so just largely from academic reasons, I wanted to find out more about this particular drug. And I discovered that there had been several patents issued on Nitramed a few years before the FDA approval. And that sparked my interest in digging a little bit deeper into patenting in this particular area and also the commercialization that arose in this particular area. And I think the interest I described is academic, but it wasn't only academic. Often issues in developing countries regarding pharmaceuticals sometimes are put to a side. And I guess one of my motivations was to point out that these access to medicine issues also arise in developed countries and have a very interesting shape and texture and context that's worth understanding. So there's a global aspect to this project, even though much of the focus is on the U.S. patent system.
You know, we're going to dig in, Shuba, into some of your observations on the show today. But let me ask kind of an overarching question before we define some terms. If you were to box yourself into a particular perspective or lens through which you want to or through which you personally view this issue, what would it be? Are you skeptical about the use of these patents? Are you bullish, to use some of these more common terms? How would you describe your own personal view top level?
Yeah, I would not describe myself as anti-patent or anti-IP. It's more trying to understand the proper place for patents and for intellectual property more broadly, and I definitely do think they have a place. And so there are two ways to think respond to your question. One is the personalized medicine context gives one way to think about the proper role of patents. If you think about patents, for example, as incentivizing certain types of invention, the big issue is should we be incentivizing invention in this particular area of personalized medicine? And so that's looking at personalized medicine as a case study for understanding intellectual property law more broadly, and really trying to understand what the proper parameters and the proper policy should be. And then the other side of your question, of course, is about personalized medicine as an avenue for research and development. I'm not opposed to that either. Again, my question is, how can we do it the most effective way? And my concern with looking at some of the race-specific patents is that the patenting may be too narrowly focused as opposed to really targeting where the needs would be for medical developments and diagnoses and treatments.
Mm-hmm. And so let's define a few terms for those that aren't familiar with patent law broadly, but particularly with this issue. And so let me start off with a phrase that you've used a few times and make sure we have it down. So what is exactly personalized medicine? How do you define that?
Yeah, so personalized medicine is a set of diagnoses or treatments that are tailored to specific characteristics of individuals. So, for example, it may be a medical treatment that's tailored to a particular ethnic group. So, for example, a company called Myriad that's been in the headlines quite a bit recently has a patent in Europe dealing with the diagnosis of breast cancer among Ashkenazi Jewish women, where there is a particular proclivity to that disease. And so a personalized medicine treatment or a personalized medicine patent would be one where either the medical diagnosis or treatment is tailored to a particular individual. And so the big issue in the book, and I think the big issue in personalized medicine, is how are we describing those characteristics? Are we accurately identifying them in order to make these types of treatments and diagnoses effective? So one way to think about this is that not all medical diagnoses or treatments work well for all individuals. And so the ideal type of diagnosis or treatment would take into account all the idiosyncrasies of a person, but that may be very difficult to do in practice, especially in terms of finding or doing research in these particular areas. And so the big question then becomes, what are the relevant characteristics in terms of understanding personalized medicine?
Now, tied to that, and you made some reference to it as well, and we're going to come back to the contours of personalized medicine in a moment. What are race-specific patents? Because of that term sounds awfully explosive, but I think it has a slightly different meaning than what one might think it means.
Right. So let's start off with the definition of a patent.
Yes.
So a patent is a grant from the government. In the United States, it's from the federal government. That gives the owner of the patent or the recipient of the patent the right to exclude others from using an invention. And so a race-specific patent is one where the patent is given to an invention that is defined along some racial lines. And so I use race-specific patents for a reason that I'll go into in a minute, but it can be any kind of tailored patents. It could be based on race. I mean, I could have written, and I do talk a little bit about what could be thought about as gender-specific patents or gendered inventions. It could be inventions that are tailored based on ethnicity. But I pick race-specific patents because, to go back to the initial Big Bang moment, as I call it in the book, for this project, the Bidel pharmaceutical, the Bidel drug that I mentioned at the beginning of our interview, there was a patent on that drug that a company called Nitramed was able to obtain in 2002 and then 2004. And that patent describes a medical treatment for hypertension, and expressly in the patent they talk about black patients. So it's meant to be a treatment for hypertension in black patients. So I would describe that as the most clear-cut example of a race-specific patent, where the invention is defined in terms of a racial a category or a racial term. And so that racial category or the racial term would then have some implications for how the drug is marketed and commercialized, and in terms of which types of patients it would be targeted as the recipients or consumers of the drug. And so that's one example. I think that's probably the most extreme example, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk more about that type of patenting. But there are also examples of what I would call race-specific patents, where even though they may not, where racial terms may not be used in the patent, the invention is clearly, if you're reading the patent, being targeted towards particular racial or ethnic groups. So, for example, I looking through the patent records, which are readily searchable, anybody can search them, I found several examples of patents for skin depigmentation or patents for straightening hair. And if you read the context of the patents, even though they do not expressly say that they're meant for a black consumer or any other type of category like that, the context in which the invention was made and the context in which the invention is supposed to be understood is one where the market is the relevant market, the relevant consumer is defined by those types of categories.
Now, this idea of categorization is something that I do want to come back to, because I think your empirical analysis is quite interesting, and it goes back, well into a period where the African American or black community was not only enslaved, but certainly where you had Jim Crow laws and other institutionalized racism that I think at least doesn't necessarily play a role in patenting generally, but certainly is the cultural context in which many of these patents perhaps were sought after. One last question by way of definition. You talk about genes and gene sequencing in the book, and I think we're going to get into that a little bit as well. So what is that?
What is a gene or a gene sequence?
Yes.
So,
more specifically, a gene sequence as it relates to patents.
Okay, so a gene as it relates to patents. So, well, a gene sequence would be an identified sequence or arrangement of certain basic amino acids that constitute a gene. and the gene would be a marker or a basis for certain type of characteristic in the organism. So it could be a human organism, it could be a plant organism. And so that would be the basic idea behind a gene sequence. And what's being patented, just to make this clear, mm-hmm. and I don't think there's much disagreement about this in terms of what can or can't be patented, is we're not talking about the gene as it occurs in nature, as it occurs in the human body. So when we're talking about an ownership that arises from a patent, we're not talking about ownership over a physical body. So in that sense, it is very different from slavery as we understand it. But it is a patent over, as you described earlier, the man-made or the sequence as it exists in a in an artificial or non-natural state, or putting maybe a little bit more a fine point on it, as it exists in a laboratory, something that can then be commercialized or marketed or studied further in that artificial setting.
Now we're chatting with Professor Shubha Ghosh, author of the book Identity, Invention, and the Culture of Personalized Medicine on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Shubha, you ask you mentioned towards the end of the book, and I think a refreshingly candid note. You point out that there is quite a bit of self promotion in the selling of a book and in the creation of the book. But then you say, so does all of this even matter? And that's a question, of course, that is designed for radio. And so let me ask you this question up front before we talk about it. And I want to get into after that how patent law has come to allow for the ownership of something that is living, but in terms of in terms of what you're describing, for an individual who is consuming medical services in the United States, and we can start there, but more broadly, why does this matter? What is your primary concern, or what is the primary issue that you want to address and that you think we should be focusing increasingly on as we consider the growth, right, of the personalized medicine industry?
Okay, so I think at a very broad level, we should be concerned about patenting in the biomedical area. And again, I'm not anti-patent. I just want to know the proper place of patents. I think there's been a lot of concern among medical practitioners regarding the amount of patenting and the types of patents that get issued in the biomedical area. So as I was writing this book, I had to go back and sort of hastily make some changes in the book to reflect the new case law, the Supreme Court was reviewing a case called Prometheus versus Mayo, which involved what I would describe as a personalized medicine patent. It wasn't a race-specific type patent, but it was a patent having to do with the treatment of Crohn's disease. And I won't go into all the technical details of the patent, but the patent covered a method of adjusting diagnostic and medical treatment of someone suffering from Crohn's disease. And so this case, the patent had been issued a few years ago, and then the Mayo Clinic was sued for practicing the diagnostic method. And so this raises a whole host of questions in terms of suits over diagnostic methods, suits over the practice of medicine. In some ways, given the human impact of medicine, it's very different than, let's say, suits over smartphones or suits over mechanical or electronic devices. Here we're dealing with, I would describe as life and death, or very personal type situations. And so I think if we allow the patenting to go on to a broader extent than I think that we have, we need to really confront some of these ethical and moral and policy, to look at sort of more mundane aspect policy implications of these types of patents. So one thing that was very interesting is that the Supreme Court in Prometheus versus Mayo did find that particular patent I just described invalid, meaning that the patent office should not have granted that particular patent. It was inconsistent with the law and the policy of patents. So I found that decision, that outcome, in some ways refreshing. it raises a whole host of questions in terms of the technical, doctrinal, and legal rules that the Supreme Court set forth. But I found it a nice sort of gift from the U.S. Supreme Court as I was completing this book last spring. So I think that's one example. And then in the area of personalized medicine, we're going to see a lot more use and understanding, as we already have, of the human genome, and that's going to affect the way in which diagnoses and treatments occur. And so to get back to this issue of race-specific patents, mm-hmm. one concern that we should have is the use of these categories. So, for example, when Nitramed used the term black patient in its patent, as a policy matter, we have to wonder what exactly that means. What constitutes someone being black? And that's a big question that, it's the butt of many jokes. And it's also the subject of serious discussion in terms of how you deal with identity. And so black patient in the Nitramed case reflected the fact that it was self-identification in the sample that they had. They were doing a Veterans Administration study of their particular drug. And so there's a self-identification aspect of that, which of course represents the background culture, the background sociology, background for mores against which terms like black would be used, or any racial or ethnic term would be used. But my biggest concern is that once we have more genetic markers, or what better genetic understanding, that a company, the patent office, whatever, will make the mistake of mixing up a sociological category with a genetic category, and we go back to the bad old days in terms of how we think about race. And so I think that's maybe in the background of what I wrote this book, and I wanted to make clear about those distinctions of the use of categories.
Well, and so on that point, Shuba, let's delve a little more deeply into this policy question from a patentable subject matter perspective, because again, I think those that are not familiar with patent law might find it surprising initially that one can patent something that is living. And the distinction, the distinction, of course, as you've pointed out, is that something is man-made, but of course that raises the larger moral question of whether man is creating life, and it literally, that's the level at which this debate occurs. I think it's particularly useful here to discuss a little bit the policy reasons behind allowing patents over something that is living in the first place. And you talk about in the book several justifications for patents, which I think are useful in thinking about this issue. So what are those three justifications as you see them, and how do they tie into this question?
So one is an incentives justification. So the idea is that if I know that I'm going to have a patent that will allow me to keep other people from making what I've come up with, making my invention, that gives me the incentive initially to make the invention. So that's the incentive to invent argument or justification for patents more broadly. That argument applies across different types of inventions, not just living organisms, though we'll talk in a few minutes about what it might mean for living organisms. So there's the incentive justification. The second justification I talk about is a commercialization type justification, and that justification is maybe I would invent the creation anyway, I would invent the product anyway, but then I need the patenting in order for me to manage the marketing and commercialization. Otherwise, once I've tried to sell it, I run the risk of it being copied by others or being used by others, undercutting any commercial or marketing plan that I have. So that's the second justification. And the third justification is what I call more of a cultural justification or an expressive justification. And that is we like invention, and we like that it's a cultural phenomenon. We want to use the patent system to promote the development of products and scientific inventions because they are cultural artifacts. So we often think about that justification coming up in the area of copyright in terms of creation of music
and film and books and paintings and so forth. But the idea is that scientific inventions also have a cultural dimension, and the patent system should be attuned to that. So those are the three justifications that I talk about in the book, or at least lay the foundation for thinking about the patent system more broadly.
So before we take a break, Shubha, the last kind of question along those lines before we turn after the break to some of the history of race-specific patents and then going forward. Broadly speaking, who are getting these kinds of patents today? And what kinds of inventions are they patenting? And you've mentioned several already, but to get a sense of the current lay of the land, where is this activity occurring, and how are these patents being used?
So you're talking about race-specific patents?
Yes, today, before we get into the history.
Okay, so let's define today maybe as the last 10 years or so.
Fair enough.
And so the book goes into different categories historically of inventions and how they developed. And so, for example, I describe several having to do with cosmetic patents. And so the cosmetic patents, I include things like skin depigmentation and the hair straightening. And we do see some cosmetic patenting still occur that's race-specific. So there's some very interesting patents on, for example, dress dummies or defining a dress dummy so that it takes account different types of body shapes and body forms. And in terms of designing or setting up those types of dress dummies, if you will, or those body shapes, there are some presumptions that there's some correlation between body shapes and ethnicity or race. So they talk often about maybe African-American body type or Hispanic body type and so forth. So there are these cosmetic patents. There's some interesting patents involving toys and games, which have a racial dimension historically, if you look at them. And currently they have types of toys or games that might have a cultural dimension to them. And the patents are covering those toys as they would market a particular racial or ethnic group. And then within the biomedical area, the pharmaceutical area, the buy-bill patent is probably the most extreme. I haven't found any that where the patent itself is written in terms of applying only to a black patient or a particular ethnic or racial group. But if you read the description of many of these biomedical patents, they're motivated by the fact, and I think this is a legitimate motivation for invention, I'm not questioning this, that certain diseases have been overlooked in patenting, certain diseases have been overlooked in research and development, and they tend to be diseases that may be associated with non-majority populations. And so the motivation behind the patent, and arguably in some cases the reason why the patent might be innovative or inventive, has to do with their focusing or targeting these particular groups. So those are the kind of patents that you might see contemporary milieu that I would define as race-specific. But other than the Bayh-Dole patent, there are none that go that extreme in terms of actually being so narrowly tailored for a particular racial group. And there are obvious economic and business reasons for that. But maybe we'll get to chat about those as well after the break.
Yes. We're chatting with Professor Shubha Ghosh of the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Law, author of the book Identity, Invention, and the Culture of Personalized Medicine Patenting on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can listen to the show, and there's a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. One way is to email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting at kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope you continue listening to the station and to Hearsay Culture. Let's talk about some of these economic reasons and as well as the history of this patenting. You in particular focus, Shuba, on literally the claim language, and I want to ask you about claims in particular and what they are. But then certain words that are used. So again, for listeners that aren't as well versed in patent law, the claims are the heart of the patent. But more specifically, what are they? And then if you could talk a little bit about the empirical analysis you did of the use of the word Negro in these race specific patents and how they play out.
Okay, so the claim, a patent claim, is the part of the patent. So just to clarify, if it hasn't been clear, maybe I should have at the very beginning, that a patent is a written legal document that is, as I say, granted by the government. And the written document does several things. One of the things that it does is describe what the invention is that the patent owner has come up with or the inventor has come up with. And the other thing that the patent document does is lay out the legal rights of the patent owner in terms of the meets and bounds or boundaries of the invention. And so the boundaries of the invention, the legal description or the legal boundaries are laid out in what are known as the patent claims. And so these are the part of the patent document that are written in the formal legal language. The rest of the patent often reads much like a scientific paper, a technical scientific paper rather than a legal document. But the claims are written in legalese to lay out exactly what is the invention. And so they serve a purpose, for example, in the context of a litigation. If I'm claiming that somebody's infringing my patent, I basically have to show that what the invention that they were using without my permission falls into the claims that are in the patent. So I gave the example of the claims in the Bidel patent talking specifically about black patients. Technically, then, if I took that medical treatment, the pharmaceutical compound that is laid out in the claims and applied it to a non-black patient, I'm not infringing because the black patient is linguistically part of the claim. And so that is the heart of actually the issue that I want to focus on in terms of how we think about race-specific patents from a policy perspective, that that type of claiming has many policy problems with it that we can be glad to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, in a nutshell, is what claims are and why they're relevant to my book. And you also asked me specifically about the word Negro.
Well, yeah. I mean, and I think it tie. I mean, I can tie it into to what you just brought up. You know, we, of course, the history of this country includes various ways to describe African Americans. Some factual, some highly pejorative, and some racist. And of course, that language is more or less reflected, with some limitations, in the patents that you studied. So if you could talk a little bit about that empirical analysis, but specifically, because I think it was pretty enlightening how the use of the word Negro, which is a word that's, you know, was used for quite a long time in describing African Americans, plays in the concerns that you and issues that you raise in your book.
Yeah, so part of that reflects just a technical concern in terms of identifying race-specific patents. But though it goes beyond that, because I wanted to do in this book or analyze in this book how patents reflect background culture, you know, background mores are, you know, have a social construction as well as a technical and a legal construction behind them. And so I had to think about what words to use in terms of identifying race-specific patents in the past. And so part of the book does see the transition. Using just the word black would uncover a lot of things that are spurious. And so I had to look at and try to use these different types of cultural terms and cultural categories that have been used, and I think are many of which are fairly archaic. I didn't do any searching based upon pejorative terms or pejorative uses for race. I didn't really think that appropriate. I didn't really think that I found something, at least in my search, mm-hmm. that used these terms expressly.
Right.
But the categories did reflect the kind of usage that was prevalent, let's say, in the 50s, 60s, and then 70s, and looking forward. And so that was largely a search strategy in terms of just trying to identify race-specific patents, but it also became very interesting to see how the patent language, not surprisingly, I guess, but still it's a sort of an interesting point to note, reflected what the background culture was.
The concerns here, and I want to talk about them. You know, to the extent that we in patent law rely upon language to describe inventions, you know, one of the one of the interesting observations that several scholars are pointing to, including Mark Lemley, is mm-hmm. are literally the limitations of words in describing physical objects. Right. And that we can't, and this is true of language generally, whether it's a patent or a contract, we have a hard time as human beings putting into words what we actually mean. And yet, when you're talking about these kinds of patents, when you're talking about personalized medicine, it would seem by definition that to personalize medicine, you must describe an individual's attributes.
Right.
How do you square the role of language in this endeavor?
So specifically in the area of personalized medicine?
Yes, I mean, specifically with regard to personalized medicine. How do you do it without running into the very problems that you raise in the book?
Right. So I think part of my response is that the way to understand patents or to think about regulating them or limiting some of the adverse effects that we might think about from patents is to start thinking about them linguistically,
mm-hmm.
Because that's how they operate in practice. And so, as you mentioned, there are lots of scholars, Mark Lemley being one, Tim Holbrook. I can name many scholars I know I'm missing. I could spend the rest of the time listing names of people doing very active work in this.
Right.
But I think the idea there is that we think about a lot of the patent policy in terms of trying to find the right set of legal categories. And so, for example, you mentioned patentable subject matter. There are those who say, well, we can deal with patentable subject matter by simply doing, for example, what's done in Europe to say business methods are not patentable, or to create certain types of legal categories that would then exclude certain things from patenting. So, for example, India and other developing countries would not even allow patents on pharmaceutical compounds until very recently. And so they would just create legal categories of exclusion from patenting. And I think a lot of the policy now, and I think the book that I've written fits into that, is saying, well, those things may not be finely tuned enough. And there are other ways in which we think about patenting that might be more targeted without necessarily ruling out whole categories. I think, as you mentioned earlier, the view in the U.S. is patenting applies to anything man-made under the sun. That's the Diamond versus Chakraborty case from 1980 to the U.S. Supreme Court. And so the philosophy of that case, I mean, the statement anything under the sun man-made might sound fairly hyperbolic, but the philosophy really is that we can't really decide which fields or which industries should be excluded from patenting. But at the same time, that doesn't preclude us from having specialized or tailored rules for different types of industries or different types of inventions. And those tailored rules could include the way we interpret or understand the real heart of a patent, which is the language, the language of the claims. And so much of the book, in terms of the policy aspects of the book, I think follow in that line. And so I would be in favor of a rule that would prevent the use of racial categories in patent claims, largely because we're not clear what those claims, what those that terminology would mean in practice, and largely because of the history of using those types of categories. It's not simply a matter of self-identification when it's in a patent claim. It has a different type of interpretive valence and a different type of use that, especially with personalized medicine and the development of genetically specific types of treatments and diagnoses, could be pernicious. As I said before, bringing back the bad old days.
Well, let's talk about that perniciousness, because you know you talk about in the book how even the phrase "black patients" in a claim can create interpretive issues. And I'll ask you the kind of the explosive question, but to get the extreme. I mean, in terms of the at least a possible standpoint, what do you see as the biggest problem associated with using that language? In other words, if you forecast a bit what the ramifications would be, let's start with the worst, in your view, possible outcome. How could this play out within the contours of patent law in a way that you see as problematic?
Yeah, and I don't view it solely within patent law. Just to expand your question a little bit,
sure.
I view it also in terms of thinking about research and development and the scientific endeavors that patent law reinforces, or patent law is certainly plays an important role in.
Okay.
And so I'm kind of concerned about research and development thinking about designer drugs that are defined in racial terms. So one of the criticisms of pharmaceutical patents, for example, is that they tend to favor high-end drugs or designer-type drugs that are affecting basically diseases or conditions that are affecting the more affluent or the more well-off, I mean, places where there is sort of a bigger commercial bang for the buck, rather than tropical diseases or, as we say, diseases that are overlooked, orphan diseases. And so one of my concerns is that the personalized medicine might be viewed as sort of a compromise. The view is that we're looking, we're not doing the Viagras, right? We're not just simply trying to find drugs that would be catering to sort of high-end type diseases. We actually are doing something that is public interested, that is looking beyond the majority. But at the same time, there may be a pernicious effect in terms of how drugs, and I think Bidel would be one example of this, reifies racial categories, really does think about racial categories largely in marketing and commercial terms rather than in terms of the needs of groups that could be defined in ways that are, maybe related to race, but also maybe independent of race as well. So I'm concerned about, and this is getting back to the three rationales we talked about earlier for patents, that it might create the wrong incentives. It might create a very strange marketplace for the commercialization of inventions. And then I think even the more dangerous of the three, that it changes the cultural landscape. Think about identity and the way in which we think about disease and treatment and medicine.
We're chatting with Professor Shubha Ghosh of University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Law, author of the book Identity, Invention, and the Culture of Personalized Medicine Patenting on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Shubha, I'm at the point now in the show that I call the unfair portion of the show, where I ask you questions that you may not or do not have adequate time to answer as thoroughly as you have up to now. So with that caveat, here's an unfair question. Towards the end of the book, propose some rules or perhaps principles through which we should think about these issues, again, from a patent law perspective, but more broadly. And you seem to be generally concerned about the use of racial categories as a basis to invalidate a patent. And so one of the rules you propose, and this gets into the weeds of patent law a little bit, but I can ask a question more broadly. You propose an idea that says that racial categories should not be a basis for finding that a patent is obvious.
Is
not obvious from the standpoint, again, for those not familiar, obviousness is probably the most often used challenge to a an issued patent. Right. And the idea fundamentally is that if a given invention would be viewed as obvious by a person having ordinary skill in the art, as identified in the statute, we don't grant a patent on it. Now, you suggest that racial categories should not be used as a basis to make such an argument. Tell us a little bit about that rule and why you think that's significant.
So that rule directly affects what happened in the Bidel case. It comes out of that background. And so the idea behind non-obviousness is that the inventor has to show that there is some sort of a step forward, that some sort of progress, however defined, has been made in the particular invention. And so an invention has to be novel for it to be patented as well as non-obvious. But the idea behind non-obviousness is that there are inventions out there that could be quite novel. They never existed before, but they don't really serve any kind of valuable purpose. They don't serve any purpose in terms of moving the field forward. They're just sort of new for being new, rather than actually being innovative or being inventive. And that's what non-obviousness is trying to get at. It's trying to be a threshold requirement to say, okay, your invention is new, but it's also deserving of a patent because it does move the field forward. It might be a game changer. It might even be just a small incremental change, but it's an important change that's deserving of a patent. And so in the Bidel case, it's very interesting because Nitromet had been in the area of hypertension medicine, and in fact had many patents on hypertension medicines that were not race-specific. And so what's interesting about the Bidel patent that it received back in 2002-2004 is that one of their other patents, their more general patents, was expiring. And so they were seeking a patent on this variation of their initially patented compound. So there was a change in the dosage and some other aspects of the particular compound. And they weren't able to convince the patent office that change satisfied the criteria of being non-obvious, that it was actually a change that was clearly made the invention new, but it wasn't really setting the moving the field forward. And if you go back and look at the history of the patenting, the administrative review of Nitromed's application, the patent office was eventually convinced of non-obviousness when Nitromed made the argument that these compounds, these changes in the compound, had special effects on the African-American population, or the black population, as they said, in their particular patent. And so this is where I think the policies are fairly tricky, and I'd be glad to talk about them, but as you say, I don't have time to do that.
Right.
But, I mean, I think one view of Nitromed's strategy was to try to simply extend the life of their patent, what's sometimes referred to as evergreening, by finding or defining this particular race-specific application. And I'm troubled by that because I'm not completely convinced that it may be motivated by treating or dealing with overlooked diseases or overlooked populations. It may have been a pure commercial motivation with maybe little benefit to the population at issue.
In the remaining few minutes that we have, Shubha, I do want to give you the opportunity to talk about some of those policy implications. And I guess I'll ask you this question. If you are, advising a pharmaceutical company going forward about the best way to use these patents and deploy them in a way that meets the social and public objectives that you have, what would you want those companies to be doing?
Well, it's good to look for market niches. Whatever the field, I think market niches can be very important. I mean, that's really where the innovation occurs. That's where the returns can be. So I think that's not something that I'm opposed to. So anything I said should not be read in that particular way or understood in that particular way. And even in the area of medicine, there are obviously overlooked areas. There are overlooked fields, overlooked diseases, overlooked treatments, overlooked forms of diagnoses. And companies should look for those niches. But there is a public interest aspect to what's going on in pharmaceuticals, and I think we need to identify those niches in a way that would benefit, even if it benefits only a particular group or a particular segment of society. I would be wholly in favor of targeting those types of diseases and trying to use these patents to effectively combat and
and deal with those types of situations. So I think the kind of, you know, to use economic or business jargon a little bit, that kind of market segmentation or that kind of identification of market niches or specialized or differentiated products is appropriate. But I think if you start thinking about it purely in racial terms, you have to at some level ask what do those categories mean and think a little bit about what the backlash would be. So that's how I think about it from within a company. And I think really the book is targeting, in terms of the policy responses, the patent office and courts and Congress in terms of how we should try to use the patent mechanism to deal with overlooked diseases and not just simply rely on maybe facile categories of race to try to deal with it.
Professor Shubha Ghosh of the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Law, author of the book Identity, Invention, and the Culture of Personalized Medicine, Patenting. Thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. You know, Shubha, you're such a prolific scholar that I do want to ask you one last question, which is what are you working on now? What can we look for coming down the pike by way of articles, books, or other writings?
Well, I've written of an article coming out in the Utah Law Review on commercial speech and pharmaceutical marketing, and that's an article that's about, again, another recent U.S. Supreme Court case called IMS versus Sorrell, where the Supreme Court struck down state regulation having to do with the use of pharmacy data for the purposes of targeting doctors by pharmaceutical companies. So that's an interesting First Amendment, a free speech pharmaceutical industry overlap that is not unrelated to what I do in this particular book. So that will be hitting the law, wherever law reviews hit, will be hitting in a couple of months.
Hitting SSRN perhaps and one or two other places. Well, look, Shubha, like I said, thank you for joining us today on the show. I think this has been a terrific discussion, and I appreciate you taking the time. Again, the book is Identity, Invention, and the Culture of Personalized Medicine Patenting. The author is Shubha Ghosh. Shubha, thanks for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you once again, David. You've been very generous and a very great sparring partner in this. So thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure. I'm happy to mention a number of guests that are coming up on Hearsay Culture. I'm in the process this week of finalizing that schedule. It has been a bit of a challenge, but not because of the inability to get guests, but more a function of my own schedule as I juggle classes, writing, administrative duties, plus being a husband and father of two wonderful boys. But having said all of that, I will have the schedule up and posted by the end of this week. This show is again being recorded on October 9th for airing on October 10th. And so I look forward to having that schedule up, and therefore being able to tell you next week and on a going forward basis who's going to be on the show. In the interim, of course, you can listen to Hearsay Culture a variety of ways. This quarter, the show is airing Wednesdays from 1 to 2 p.m. Pacific time, and you can listen to the show live in the Bay Area or by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu. The show also is posted as a podcast after it is aired on KZSU, and you can get the show either by going to Stanford Center for and Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to the iTunes page for CIS, or by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all of the previous 170-plus shows, plus the upcoming schedule. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback on anything going on the show by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. So I thank you for taking the time today to listen to the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.